introducing Marty Feder, Sunday morning, 9:45, as we have a shear from Marty Feder on Pshat in the Pasuk, or something connected to Pesach. We'll leave it up to Marty. Take it away.
Well, there will also be Pshat in the Pasuk. Yeah, okay. Pesach, what's that? Okay. Good morning, gentlemen, for those of you who went to sleep last night. For those of you who didn't, if you fall asleep, Bruce will be sure to wake you up. Because I can't really say that my content this morning will do so, but that's okay. Deck. All right. Yes, sirs. We just read Parshat Tazria. And there are a number of different things. Not too many. Don't worry. Not too many things I'm going to talk about in Tazria, but a couple. And you're all saying to me, how can he, what does he have to talk about in Tazria? You know, everybody always talks about Lashon Hara v'Tzaraat and all that. But let me talk about the beginning of Tazria. But the Baal Shem Moshe Lemor, God spoke to Moses saying, Daber al Bnei Yisrael Lemor, speak to the people of Israel saying, Isha ki Tazria v'yalada zachar, a woman who, we'll talk about what Tazria means in a moment, v'yalada zachar, and she gives birth to a male, and she should be impure for 7 days, just like as if she were a nida. Which is interesting, because a nida, a Torah, in biblical, is not 7 days. So it doesn't mean that she should be 7 days like a nida, because the whole concept of Shiva Nikiim, of counting 7 days after the last blood is seen, 7 full days, and then that will be when she goes to the mikvah and no longer becomes impure and becomes pure, does not apply to a nida. Okay, but in the biblical meaning, it applies to a zava. A zava is a woman who has blood or other issue, not when, according to her regular menstrual period. Okay, and the Rambam, which I learned from my father, Olam Hashalom, because he wanted me to understand some of this, the Nida, who has a regular period, the day after her regular period, in theory, she can go to the mikvah, and she's fine. Midoraita. Midoraita, Zava, who has an irregular issue, she has to count 7 days at the end, doesn't matter how long it is.
That's not how it was originally, that Durabanan. If you go through
Wait, let me finish.
When she fled at an unusual time, 1 day, she waited 1 day. When it was 2 days,
Let me finish what the Rambam says. Okay, Rambam says if it's during her regular timing, if it's every 28 days and so forth, then you know it's normal at the end of her regular period. In theory, if she no longer sees it at 12 o'clock noon, she could be Tovel that night, in theory. Okay? And she is no longer a Nida. Okay? Because it's regular. If something is irregular, then she is a Zava, which means she has an issue. She's an issuer. She has an issue. And we have an issue with that. And therefore, we don't know what it is. Therefore, at the end of seven, when she no longer has any problem, she counts 7 pure days and becomes a then she goes to the mikvah and becomes tahara. What the Rabbanim did is they said, well, you know, now we're sure. I mean, what's regular, what's not regular? The whole thing is highly irregular. So we will apply the chumrah of the zava category also to the nida. Okay? Which is why there are loopholes and all kinds of things for women who are in such a situation that their regular menstrual period doesn't allow them to become pregnant, so there are people you can rely on.
Marty, can I read you a quote from the Rambam here that I have in my Rabbi Hoffman book? That the Rambam claimed that the abrogation of the biblical leniency, he's referring to Adam Tahor, did not occur until the Gaonic era. Moreover, he denied that the more demanding standard was universal Jewish practice, since he asserted it was accepted in Babel, Eretz Israel, and Spain, but not in France. On this matter, the Rambam recognized the legitimacy of divergent regional customs, which is quoted in Hilchot Isur Bia. And he goes on later to say that the Rambam mentions a fringe practice in some Jewish communities for couples not to have sexual relations for that 40 days after the birth of a boy, 80 for a girl. He regarded this as a heretical custom copied from Siddukim and considered the uprooting of that practice to be a religious obligation. So basically, a lot of the Rishonim were completely opposed to what we do today, and it gradually took hold over hundreds of years.
Okay, what I'm suggesting is, first of all, now you tell me, you read that little section about that it wasn't accepted in France. All I can say about that is, since my ex-wife was French, now you tell me? Anyway, that's interesting what you point out. It doesn't contradict what I was saying, which is that the Chumrah applies to a Nidah, and so that. You know, there are different customs also amongst the Ethiopians, which I don't really know, understand, but you know, they practice it much more rigorously, to some extent. I'm not
Well, they
sufficiently
take
familiar
the
with it. Then,
dam, it's dam tahor, literally, meaning it's
well, wait a
pure.
minute. Let me get to that.
Because
Let me get to that. Well, I'm
dam.
talking about. I'm just thinking about the first pasuk, which says, "V'tamah, and what I wanted to say here is, you know, you shouldn't read it. And she shall be impure for 7 days, just like a nida. All right? But it means she shall be impure 7 days, just with applying the same rules as if she was a nida.
No,
Okay?
not
So when I'm
exactly.
saying that
But those 7 days, the impure rules are applied in the Beit HaMikdash and things Kadosh, not related to
a nida.
matter
Right.
related. Not related to
Well,
matter.
you know, it certainly is related, because if a woman is a nida, that's not true.
No,
All of
because
them.
it's not any, it's called Dam Tahor. It's pure blood that
No,
only
you're
prevents
confusing.
her.
Excuse me, Bruce. You're confusing two things. There's a period of 7 days, and there's a period of 33 days for if
Yeah,
she
so
gives
Dam
birth
Tahor
to
is the 33 days. That's Dam Tahor.
correct. I'm not talking about that. It says
No.
here for the first 7 days, v'tameh shivat yamim, and she should be impure for 7 days. Kimei nidat devotah tima, as the days of when she is a nida, she shall be impure. And
Right.
what I'm going to point out, you didn't read it as the same number of a days of a nidah, because that would imply that a nidah is 7 days, but biblically she doesn't. Okay? But you should read the Vitame, she shall be impure for 7 days, and you apply just like the rules, just like the days of when she is a nidah. So doesn't it go through and tell you all that? Okay? But don't confuse things here. All right? And the 33 days are Yemei Tahora, okay? Days of purity. All right, where she can't do, I don't know exactly what she can't do. She can't touch the anything in the Kodesh, and she shouldn't go to the Beit HaMikdash until she finishes those 33 days at the end of 40 days. Okay, now I promise you, Isha ki tazria. What is tazria? Okay, there's a Gemara that says, Isha mazria tchila yoledet zachar. The question of who reaches orgasm first. In other words, the woman reaches orgasm first, then the chances are that she's going to have a boy. Okay? And if the man, the chances are she'll have a girl. Okay? That's sort of what the Gemara says. And it's very interesting, because there are scientific studies that show that the naftik, the entryway, a woman's entryway, changes acidity after she reaches orgasm, and that there are certain sperm that are more affected by the acidity of the entryway. I don't know which way it works, but it becomes less acidic or more acidic. In any event, it favors the male sperm. Okay, whereas if the man, you know, reaches orgasm first, before the acidity changes, then it's favor of a girl. Now, that's a scientific study that was done a while back. And the Gemara preceded it by at least how many years? Close to 2,000 years, well, 1,800 years. But that's the Gemara. I'd like to suggest that that's not the Pshat. Okay, the Pshat is Isha ki tazria, a woman who ovulates. Okay, so that's what she does to produce her zera, just like the man, you know, doesn't have that. The woman, when she ovulates, Okay? And so we would read it, a woman when she ovulates and she gives birth to a male. And a few pasukim down the line, it says, v'imnekevat, two pasukim down the line, it says, v'imnekevatelet, and if she gives birth to a girl, then she has 2 weeks of tumah as a nida and 66 days of the Tahora. And we'd like to say the way she be read is just, you know, that the first part says, if a woman ovulates, y'all does a chal. Okay? And the second part basically means, Ishakita zriya keva. But it doesn't go through the whole point again. So why does it say Ishakita zriya? We know that a woman doesn't give birth unless she ovulates. That's rather obvious. But what's the opposite? If she doesn't ovulate, she is barren. She's an akara. How do we tell the difference? Well, folks, there really is no way to tell the difference. You know, objectively, externally. Okay? We know that when she has her period, then she then no longer, you know, then the whole thing's sloughed off. But we don't know what the time of ovulation is and when the. So the Torah reminds us, Isha ki tazriya, a woman who ovulates, and that is, as they say, b'chasdei Hashem, right? We know this from all the our foremothers who were barren and so forth, that this is a gift that God regulates. And so it's reminding us before he goes into the whole business that Isha ki tazriya, say thank God for Isha ki tazriya, because without that, she's not going to give birth to a male or to a female. Are there any questions so far? Thank you, Bruce, for not having any questions. The next question that begs itself, though, is, hey, wait a minute. Why this difference between a boy and a girl? Why is it double tumah and double yemei taora for a girl? Okay. I mean, besides the fact that life is unfair and that girls always get the, you know, they're always deconsidered, but that's not really the case. I've seen many different answers to that question, many of them philosophical. Okay. I just was reading something the other day, yesterday, that, you know, that the man, that the boy is closer to the mother. I don't get it. We'd like to suggest the following. Why is there this whole business? What's the whole business about?
Which
Okay,
bit, or
the whole
what?
business of the sitting on Yemei Tahora. Why is it? What's the point? Okay, in Pasuk Zion, yeah, so the two Pasukim came down. So we talked that when she finishes her days of purity, whether it's a male or whether it's a son or a daughter, she brings a 1-year-old lamb and a dove. Or a ben yonah for a chatat, petach to the entrance to the ohel moed to the kohen. V'yikrivei lifnei Hashem v'chiper aleha, and he shall sacrifice it to God, and he will make amends for her. I don't know how to. I have not come up with a good word to translate v'chiper kapara. You know, certainly not. I mean, in modern Hebrew, kapara alecha. No, that's not it. To
Are
make
you
amends.
asking? Are you asking how the Dom Tover eventually got canceled?
No. Let me finish. Bruce, you got to give me a little. Every time you want to say something, give me 45 more seconds.
No, I mean, is it was that your question?
No. Question is, why double? So now the question is, well, let's look and see what the whole point of this is. Okay? When she finishes, what happens? That's what the Torah tells us. And he brings this lamb and the bird. He sacrifices them. V'chiper aleha. Right? By the way, it doesn't say v'ikrivam, v'ikrivo. I guess one would have to say it applies to he sacrifices the sacrifice, which is composed of both the lamb and the dove. Okay, because otherwise you'd say he sacrifices them, but it doesn't sacrifice. It says he sacrifices it. Okay, so that's an interesting thing that v'ikrivo it means the korban and not the one of them. And he will make amends for her. Why? What happens afterwards? And she shall become pure from where her blood issues. Zot to atay.
You have to unmute.
I'd like to suggest the following. The default status is the boy. She gives birth, 7 days of impurity as a nida, 33 more days of pure blood, whatever that means, the Tamei Tahora, okay? And then she brings the thing. Why? And then she is becomes pure from the involvement of the fount of her blood, right? Okay. What happens when there's a girl? When there's a girl, there are two females involved. There's the mother and the daughter. So we have two founts of blood. We have two females involved. And that's why we'd like to suggest that it's double trouble. That's why she has 14 days of Nida and 66 days of Dmei Tahora, in order to be able to get to the state where she is pure from the blood of her fount, whatever that means, both for herself and for her daughter. I haven't seen that anywhere else, so I'm sort of suggesting it. Okay, but it's, makes sense. Yes, Bruce, you had a question, or two, or three.
I wanted to comment that because of the complexity of the laws related to when a woman originally would have blood at an irregular time and how long she should refrain, my comment here in my Rabbi Hoffman notes, he says, Rabbi Zeira, a third generation of Amor, reports that the daughters of Israel took astringency upon themselves. Even if they see a drop of blood the size of mustard seed, they're going to wait 7 clean days. But he says this astringency very quickly became a universal practice within Jewry. And there's some scholarly debate whether Zera's report accurately portrays this history. And he goes on to explain it's probably made up, And that, considering the overall severity of needle laws in the actual practice since the 3rd century CE, it's hardly surprising that the Yoledit's leniency of Damter eventually was abolished and forgotten. But he goes to many Rishonim that took great umbrage at the idea of trying to alter a black and white Deraita for questionable issues related to fearful this, fearful that. It's quite interesting. I was told recently by friends of mine that because of the war, when husbands are in and out of Gaza and they're home very briefly, and that this has been going on in Israel for a period of time among front people, the idea to ignore those rabbinic laws, and it's been sped up because of the war when so many men are home so briefly. And they're only talking about front people, very front people. I don't know if that'll come to any fruition or bear seed in any way, but I'm told that there's a movement afoot. Not to do with the foot, but that's what's actually going on in practice. But it is interesting that they couched it in terms of, well, the women they wanted, they God forbid they should make a mistake, so everyone agreed to these extra days. And some of the Rishonim are very strong. It's like worse kid comments than like on kidney. They said this is up at Corsic, it's copying
But
the Rinnim. It's ridiculous. It's against marriage. It's against it destroys couples. On and on and on. It's very interesting. But despite all that, it seems to have taken hold among the average from the Torah world.
the first thing you have to understand, I think, is that using the Bruce Markowitz approach to history and Torah, that actually it was a movement by women to punish men.
But it's not
So,
mine. I only quote other sources. I have no opinion on the matter. What do I know?
well, I know you never have an opinion. You just tell me what you think. Tell us what you think. So
No, I quote other people. I have no idea what to say about the matter.
Anyway, this is clearly
Not my scope.
a plot by women to punish men. And in addition to which, you have to realize that makes it easy for the woman, you know, because it only leaves her about 20 days in which she has to say, "Not now, I have a headache." I mean, this is a great excuse for 10 days. You don't have to say any headache, anything
I
else.
asked my wife, and I'm sure if you ask your wife, a lot of women right after having a baby, they're kind of happy to take a little bit of a break. I
No,
mean,
but we're
it's.
talking about regular nida. Regular nida, you know, that's it's a couple of days, 2, 3 days, and then the seven nikkiyim, and which are in theory biblically non-required, but that gives the woman 7 extra days that she doesn't have to find excuses. So, and by the way, I don't have a wife at the moment, so that's okay. You know, so that's one thing. Now, on the other hand, yes, when you give birth, the woman generally is not inclined to intimidate from a period of time ranging from a couple of months to a couple of years. At least that was my experience. So, you know, that's fine, but that's not what the Torah is necessarily talking about. Torah here is talking about purity and impurity.
They also made an interesting comment in this article that if a woman is sort of like gushing blood, men would naturally want to stay away. So they can't believe that they should be lenient enough to allow the couple to have relations while she's actually, by calling it pure blood. The custom of the time, at least in the Middle East, was if it's red, stay away. So that they find it unbelievable that it would be a shot. Like it can't
Is
be.
that
That was.
why you talk we talk about a red flag? Okay, all right. No, I you know, this is like, you know, the reason we don't eat pork is so as not to get trichinosis. All right? Yes, indeed, if you don't eat pork, you won't get trichinosis. Is that the reason the Kodesh Baruch Hu said for us not to eat pork?
We'll never
That is,
know.
no,
We'll
it's not, because if he
never
was,
know. We'll never
then if
know.
we could be sure that whatever piece of pork doesn't have any trichinosis in it, then we could eat it. But we can't. You know, the same idea here is it's nice to say that, you know, this is to give the woman a break. She doesn't have to say yes or no for a few for a
But I
month or
think
two.
you did have to speak to the generation of the day, and if trichinosis was common from pork, so why not? Why not? Then what? So what if that's true?
I'm not saying what I'm saying is, but we as believing Jews don't say trichinosis is the reason for not eating pork.
Think the Rambam was a very much believing Jew, and if he said it, it's good enough for me.
He didn't say it because he didn't say that if we can be sure that this piece of pork will not give you trichinosis,
No,
you can
just.
eat it.
Possible that it's a health issue.
Yes, of course. It's possible that this is a marital relations issue and all kinds of other things. But it's also possible that it could be something else. Why is that important? Because if we know for sure that it's not the issue that we've identified, nonetheless, it is not going to change what the Torah says.
No, of course, but without
I mean,
rationale,
that's very big, of course.
we don't have to bother looking for reasons. Just God said it's a do it. But we
No.
look for reasons just in case. It's
Man
just.
is curious, and man always looks to find reasons and things. That's why I brought in the scientific study about, you know, the acidity, right? It's nice. You know, it's like there are two kinds of archaeologists. One goes and does a dig and says, "Ah, wow, you know, this is really in accordance with what the Tanakh says." And then there's the other one who does the dig and looks at it and says, "Ah, this proves that what the Tanakh says is true because, which and what you Michal, hey Natasha Me'alav, which means that because that if I hadn't found this, that I wouldn't believe the Talmud, the Tanakh, right? We know whom I'm talking about. I won't name any names because you and I both did the same course, Bruce. All right, but there are two kinds. It's the same thing here. You know, we can look for all the nice." Comforting scientific explanations and so forth and so on, and it is good, but you have to look at it as a you know, sort of a buttress.
Oh, you're muted.
I mean, to buttress what the Torah says is nice to have, but it's not to be looked at as a proof that whatever it says in the Torah or the Tanakh is true. That's my personal, and I've buttressed that with lots of other, you know, other people have the same idea. Okay.
No, you're muted again. You're muted.
I'm sorry.
There you
Okay. Now, the other thing I want to talk about is Tzaraat before I get into talk about perhaps Zeitan left with Pesach. Tzaraat, if you look carefully, is an interesting disease. It is a disease that is present only if there is partial application of the disease to the body. In other words, if you're all white, if you have white patches, you are tameh. Okay. If you become fully white with tzaraat, you become pure. V'ra'ah in Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Yud Gimel, in 13 squared, which equals 169. V'ra'ah HaKohen, and the Kohen saw, V'hineh Chisetah HaTzara'at Kol B'saro. The Tzara'at covered all his flesh. V'tihar et hanega, and he, et hanaga, sorry, V'tihar et hanaga, and he shall declare that the nega, the affliction, the ailment, is tahor, is pure. Kullo hafach lavan, tahoru. Everything is turned white and it's tahor. It doesn't say it's not tzaraat, because he nechisitah tzaraat at kol b'saro. The tzaraat, the leprosy, which is not leprosy in today's modern medical jargon, something else. I don't know exactly what it is. I don't know that we know exactly what it is. But if the coin sees that the tzaraat, not something else, but the ailment is called tzaraat, but covers his entire body of the tzaraat, of the leper, not of the coin, right? And he shall declare the ailment to be tahor, pure. So I don't know how often this particular issue is pointed out. So a person can be a leper only if he has patches.
You know? I think the idea there is having patches, he has a possible way back with a cure. If he's 100% covered in it, it's not that he's tahor, meaning he's okay. He's just so far gone that he has no ability to come back into the fold. So they'd say, you know what? He's as good as dead. We'll call him tahor. He ain't coming back. But if he has patches, then he can process him.
That's an amazing supposition, hypothesis, and suggestion.
Yes, I didn't make that. I read it too.
However, it is totally destroyed by the fact that you weren't aware of the pasuk that follows this one, which says, and on the day upon which he sees a portion, a patch of regular flesh, he will become impure again. So nice try, buddy, but it's no good. It is.
Why doesn't that seem logical?
Because the Torah says it could come back. It's not that it's never going to come back. No. He is now temporarily all white. Mighty white of you. And if it starts to come back so that a portion of his skin turns back to normal, then he's patched again, he has patches, and he becomes impure. Okay? So, you got to be careful here. You got to be careful. Why is this not working right? Pardon me. A bit of a problem with the focus. I guess I'm not focused today. Anyway. So the idea here is that the whole concept of tzaraat is that it is neither fully this way nor fully this way. It's sort of an interim condition. Now, what is the importance of that? What's the Torah trying to tell us? I don't know. Frankly, I don't know. But when we talk about tzaraat, if I wanted to be Hasidish, I would say that, everyone says that tzaraat is a punishment for lashon hara, right? And therefore, and that comes from Miriam, right? Miriam, who was said bad things about Moshe because he took a Negro lady, and so she was complaining about it, and therefore when God called her, she turned total into a leper. So 7 days, and so everyone waited for her, and so forth and so on. And they say, therefore, we know that Tzaraat is a punishment for Lashon Hara. It is also probably a punishment or an affliction for lots of other things that we don't know about. Okay? And the true punishment for leprosy is you're sent out of the encampment of Israel, you're outside the walls, until you become one or the other, right? So you become either totally white or back the way you used to be. So it's an affliction where you set whether the punishment is galut. The only other sin for which I know, or I can think of at the moment, for which there is galut, is murder. Right? We all know about Avraham Miklat. If he kills them by accident, right? Cain, who killed on purpose. Also, Navanat Yabalat, it's galut. So we have to sort of figure out the whole business about exactly what it means. I'll leave that to you. On the other hand, the concept of, you know, the list of someone who uses their tongue, you can use it for good, use it for bad, right? Use it for both. Well, that's sort of like patchy, right? But if you use it only for good or only for bad, then you're incurable one way or the other at the moment, so it's okay. That was what I would say if I was a Hasidic Rebbe, but you're very lucky that I'm not. So I won't say that.
It's interesting that only the Kohen can make the declaration of
No, because that was the Kohen's role was to sacrifice and to be the arbiter in all issues of
No, but in this case, he can know absolutely nothing. Have them a consultant who tells him, and then he makes the announcement. It's just
that's
the
right.
Like,
that's right.
It's like Pence counting the electoral votes. You know, does he have authority to examine it deeply, or he's just reading the mail? So here, the Cohen is meant to just make the announcement. He doesn't have to know a thing. He can have an assistant.
First of all, there are two things I want to say about that. One is that I find your analogy wonderful in it's being so ludicrous, but that's okay. The second is that if you take the analogy of the judicial system in Israeli law, or not Israeli law, but you know, Torah law, the animal, the meat, is kosher or non-kosher based upon the declaration of the rabbi or the shochet, right? If it's totally treif and he says it's kosher. And there are lots of other things like that as well.
No, but that's based on merit. You know what I'm saying?
Wait a minute. No. Even if he doesn't know anything, I get
no merit.
Whatever it is. Now, the Kohen is the same thing. The Kohen, first of all, the Kohen had to study, right?
There is a Gemara about it. If he knows absolutely nothing.
I'm saying, but that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. That's their role. If we are hit by a Kohen who's an Amoraite, okay, we're hit by a Kohen who's an Amoraite. The system is set up so that the Kohanim are there for two things, to the best of my knowledge. One is to do the sacrifices, and the other is to officiate in all that is concerned with and determine, make determinations about all that is Tum'ah v'Tahorah. Okay, purity and impurity. So that's the now the challenge here effectively is to decide, you know, if he is Tahor or not. And I'll continue to read what it says. Right? I said, and if the guy's totally white, and the day that he sees regular flesh, he becomes impure. And the coin will see the regular flesh. It's called the living flesh. And she's declared to be tameh. The living flesh makes it become tameh. Now it's tzaraat. It was tzaraat before. What does it mean, tzaraat? Nega tzaraat, shehu tameh. Oh, chi yashuv habasar chai v'nehpach lelavan. And if it should happen again, that the regular flesh turns back to white. So he's totally white. He has a patch that becomes regular flesh. It's tameh. that patch becomes white again. And the Kohen shall see him, and the affliction shall turn white. And the Kohen shall declare the affliction to be tahor, pure. Tahor, it is pure. So the determination of the Kohen is what makes it one way or the other. Clearly that way. Okay? In the 5 minutes remaining, or 6 minutes remaining, I'd like to say something about Pesach. If you want, don't want me to say anything more about the Mitzvah. Okay? So let's just go back to Parashah from 2 weeks ago, which is Parashat HaChodesh, right? In Egypt, God says, it says specifically, God talked to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, say, right? Because in theory, he talked to Moses, you know, where there were holy sites, burning bush. He's talking to him in Eretz Yisrael, and he says, HaChodesh hazeh lachem rosh chodeshim. This month shall be for you the primary month, the head of all other months. Doesn't say the first month. It does say, right after that, it says, Rishon hu lachem l'chodesh ha'shana. It is the first month of all the months of the year. Now we know that the Mishnah says, Arba Rashei Shanaim, there are four different beginnings to the year. Rosh Chodesh Nisan, Tu Bishvat for the trees, Rosh Hashanah, the seventh of the first day of the seventh month for the creation of the world, and there's a fourth one which escapes my memory at the moment. Someone, I'm sure, will tell me what it is.
As a point, I don't know what it was in Egypt, but in Mesopotamia, where these names come from, like Nisan, that was their first month of the year as well. It's no big.
Okay, no, well, we have a major innovation, which is the leap year, because it's that you have to keep it to be b'chodesh aviv. Today you're going out in the springtime, and therefore Nisan always has to be in the springtime. Which is why if we're missing a month, we add a month in order to spring forward. Okay, forget it. That was terrible. Now. What I'd like to do is sort of talk about the fact that being the first month makes it the first month for B'nai Israel. Right? This is the one that they're considered to have the first month. 6 months later, Rosh Hashanah is the first month of the creation for the Kadosh Baruch Hu. And what is it for us? It says twice, it says clearly, Yom Teruah Yehiyeh Lachem. For you, it shall be a day of sounding the shofar, okay, the day of making noise. And I'd like to point out that here when it says Achodesh Zeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim, this month is for you the beginning of all the other months. We shown Hu Lachem L'Chodesh Hashanah. It is the first month for you of all the other months. In other words, not the reason that the word Lachem is repeated, we'd like to suggest, is the fact that it's only the first month for you, for B'nai Israel. Okay? It is not the first month of creation, which belongs to the Kodesh Baruch Hu. So it's an opposition to the concept of the first month of the creation of the world. B'nai Israel were created, so to speak, at the diametrically opposed time of the year. It was in Nisan, which is 6 months exactly away from the time that the Kodesh Baruch Hu created the world. Okay. And it says, Yom Teruah Yehiyeh Lachem, for you it shall be a day of sounding, and here it's not that. It says Lachem twice. This is your first month. For you and you alone, it shall be the first month of the year. Now, you're telling me that it happens in Mesopotamia? That's nice. I'm glad to hear that. And I know what you would say in today's context of geographical context in Mesopotamia, you would say to me, Bruce, I told you so. But you know, again, that doesn't bother me, and it doesn't, you know, make it doesn't reinforce per se. What we'd like to say is that this has a specific purpose for us in Israel, because this is the month in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us out of Egypt. That's the significance of this, and therefore it is our first month. Okay, and why didn't HaKadosh Baruch Hu take us out of Egypt the first day of the first month? Because of all the things that happened during the next 15, right? You took the seh, you took the lamb, and you tied it to the doorpost for almost 2 weeks. Okay, then you shechted the whole business. But okay, anyway, so the concept is that this is the first month for us, which has significance and importance of its own. Okay, and now I want to talk a bit for a minute about the blood, because we started off with the blood of the Nida, and it's very nice for me to finish with the blood of the Korban Pesach, which I hadn't planned to say that, but that's, you know, where did we put the blood? Right? Sorry?
On the doorpost.
Well, no. Close. It should be put on the two doorposts and the lintel. Right. Okay. And then it says that later on that prevented the mashchit, the pestilence, from coming and affecting the firstborn of Bnei Israel.
How do you like that for a reason?
Wait a minute. I want to point one thing out, if I can find it. It says that when it happened, okay, when it actually happened, it says, and you shall take like a spongy, I forget the name of the plant, it's a spongy plant, and you shall dip it in the blood that is on the safadelet. Safadelet is the door, the entranceway, the where you step over into the door. So that means that when they shechted it, there was blood on the bottom, okay. And what this means is that you now have blood on all four sides, and any pestilence trying to come through has to go through blood that is on all four sides. That forms an impenetrable barrier, and the pestilence can't come in and affect the firstborn of Bnei Israel. And that is what we like to say is the meaning of, well, you know, that. And what does it say? It says that this will prevent, and Hashem will pass to afflict the Egyptians. So you see the blood that, in addition to being on the bottom, is on the lintel and on the two doorposts. He will skip over that entrance. And skip over the entrance, we like to say, he won't let the angel of death or whatever to come into your houses to apply to afflict you, to apply like a pestilence, like a illness, right? The illness, you can't get in. And we like to suggest that comes about because the blood is actually on all four sides, not only on three sides, but the remainder of the blood was left there and protected from all four sides. Our next speaker is here, I believe.
Yes. I want to thank you, Marty. That was a great
thank you, Shavua Tov. Thanks to everyone. We won't see each other for 2 weeks and only come back 3 weeks from now, if I'm not mistaken.
Not next week, and right.
Not the following week, which is Erev Shvi Shel Pesach. Yes. So the week thereafter. Chag Hashem Sameach, everybody. And I'm very glad our next speaker is here because he's believing me. Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, Marty. Stay safe. Thank you. Stay well and stay healthy.
You too, all of you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.